Good morning. Welcome to the May 12th edition of the Senate Committee on Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee. Today we continue with House Bill 5023, which is the Department of Fish and Wildlife budget bill. We are in the midst of overviews of the different divisions within Department of Fish and Wildlife. Yesterday we had a rather interesting hearing, a public hearing that was specially scheduled from 1 till 4. It lasted actually until 4:30 yesterday, and we had over 30 witnesses testify on Department of Fish and Wildlife issues. And I wanted to thank the committee members for coming not only to that hearing, which was in addition to the normal order of business that we had for Tuesday morning sessions. So we had two meetings of the Natural Resources Subcommittee for Ways and Means, but also because members of this committee are also members of the Salmon Restoration Committee, and they actually had to go back-to-back yesterday at 1 to 4 p.m. for Natural Resources Subcommittee, and then that lasted until 4:30, and then we went from 4:30 till about 8 on salmon restoration issues. And I don't know if members of the public understand that it can require an extraordinary commitment to sit through 6, 7, 8 hours of testimony on issues related to natural resources and salmon restoration, but I appreciate particularly the committee members who were able to cut loose from their other duties and come and listen to the public on this issue, the budget for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I thought the testimony was really interesting. I'd like the director to summarize for the record what he heard, and maybe the members of the committee can interact a little bit on what we heard from the members of the public in the testimony last night. So, Mr. Greer, I'd like to ask you, what did you hear from the public at our meeting last night?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jim Greer, Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I appreciate the opportunity to have a chair at the table last night. I think we've heard a number of things. First of all, I think there was some agreement that we can't please everybody, and there's folks on both sides of almost every issue. I think there are some issues regarding the landowner preference program that we need to take a look at. In fact, that bill or that program will have a sunset here in the next couple of years. So I think we need to open that up and take a look at. Particularly on the landowner side, we did hear there are some concerns about how we might modify that program to benefit the landowners more. I think there was a fairly unanimous agreement of the contribution that landowners make to wildlife and wildlife habitat in this state, and that wherever we can, we need to do a better job of accommodating those issues, particularly when it comes to damage on private land. I heard fairly good support for our budget from most folks. I think there's a very good statement by most people that we need those biologists in the field and we need Oregon State Police officers, and an increase, essentially, in terms of those levels of coverage we currently have. We had quite a number of representatives from the commercial fishing industry as well, and they articulated well that there is a lack of data and research that's needed for a better understanding of what's going on in the ocean, particularly when it comes to groundfish, and that the programs that we have in place now are needing improvement or expansion in terms of what we can and cannot do. And in general, I think there was support for general funds to replace or add to what currently is being carried by the hunter and the fisher relative to the financial burden to license and take. Just off the top of my head, that would be a quick summary of what I heard.
Well, I appreciate that because you've articulated well the kind of messages that I heard. And I think there is an evolution of understanding about how great is the contribution of private landowners to habitat fishing, and that there's at least some sense that landowner values need to be better heard from the department folks. And if there is a strategy that comes out of habitat management or measure 66 issues related to wildlife habitat, which is specific to that measure, maybe that translates into a little better tools for helping private landowners cope with having such a concentration of wildlife on their lands that they're also trying to pay taxes on, make a living from. So we put a lot of burden on the private landowners. They need to get more management assistance from the agencies to cope with those issues. But I think we are on a learning curve, and there are some new tools that we didn't have in the past, so that's hopeful. The other thing is I just really believe that the message that Representative Thompson's been trying to bring to the legislature about the value of ground fishing and the need to connect better with the fishing industry in terms of rulemaking and regulatory interface is really critical. $100 million industry is a pretty significant coastal industry, and so that message came through fairly well. The other thing is I think that the agency, even though it's perceived to have some problems, has enormous capital out there and public support, enormous potential for doing things that will improve the opportunity and the acceptance of programs that, that the agency runs. And well, I hope it doesn't squander that capital, because it's substantial. I don't know if maybe only one or two other agencies that have the high profile that the Department of Fish and Wildlife does. And for all of its critics, it's still the one of the agencies that's viewed as having the best potential for delivering quality water issues in Oregon. So, boy, that's something that it's yours to use or lose. And that's an awesome responsibility. Director, that sort of falls on your plate. Any of the other members care to make a comment on the hearing last night? Quite interesting, as far as I was concerned. Okay, thank you. We were in the middle of the, or beginning, the Habitat Division overview, and that's probably what we ought to pick up.
Mr. Chair, before we get started, I'd like to pass out some things to the committee. There's some additional testimony that we received from either through fax or through the mail that I hand out. We have the sport fishing and big game regulations that the chair asked for yesterday. And we have the copy of the tape from the Pacific Fishery Management Council meeting regarding the department's testimony on the groundfish. And a transcript is on its way. So any community member that would like to listen to these can let me know and I'll provide them.
Thank you. Let's do the distribution. Also, there's an issue that we brought to the table the other day, and that was the complexity of the sport fishing regulations. And I asked Mr. Rocca to bring them and share them with the members of the committee, and I'll just give you the same challenge that I gave my son. Okay, if you've got 15 minutes to figure out where we can fish on the Mackenzie and what we can fish for, we've got our general fees and licenses. And if you can figure out when a trout isn't a trout and when it's a steelhead and when a steelhead's a salmon, you can put a gold star on the page, because I couldn't figure it. We just decided we did stop it down in Cape Dora State Park.
Probably an Irish Italian collaboration of writing or something.
I'll tell you what, it's certainly arcane and very hard to understand.
Sure.
Senator?
Yes. This is fascinating, and I was looking through this with your comments in mind, and I realize I'm not one of the certifiably smart people, so with that as a caveat, I can't find in here anywhere the Sandy River heads upstream to Marmot Dam, and I can't find Sandy River above Marmot Dam or Sand or Zigzag, and I don't find anything under special regulation. What am I missing here? Where are those listed, or how do I figure out what? I happen to know what the regulations are, but it's not because it's in here. Where is it? You know, Jim?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Sure, Mr. Chair. By all means, page, chapter, and verse references are allowed.
Senator Messenger, if you're taking the sport fishing regulations, essentially under the beginning of the section, we have statewide regulations. After you pass those first couple of ads, that's how we regulation as well. But statewide regulations are what are used to apply to any body of water, whether it's a river, pond, reservoir. if it does not have a central regulation on it. So if it is not found within the section, such as your area would probably be under the dynamic section where the Sandy River is found, I believe, then there wouldn't be any other special regulations if not noted under the Sandy River itself. So for those areas upstream, the statewide regulations would apply. And then you'd look for the species that you were trying to catch under those statewide regulations. That would tell you the time frame when the season's open and, of course, the bag limit and size limits.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out now how that would apply. Could you help me with that? I'm sorry to indulge you here, but this is very confusing. I'm on statewide regulations, and I'm on the Sam up on the upper stand, your big red beggars. I'm trying to figure out what is applying here. Yeah, that's not above that. So, and page 6 and 7, right, Jim?
Yeah.
Okay. So where do I, how do I figure out when I'm on the upper Sandy or Zigzag or Sandy, Salmon River, what the regulation is? I look under Salmon and Steelhead.
Correct.
It says same tag fees apply.
Right. And let's, I think what we need to do is just go to page 44 where it talks about Sandy River. First, you have statewide regulations that tell you what your license requirements
right.
are.
Right. Okay. So that doesn't help. All right.
So that gives you a pretty good idea of what's required there.
Right. And then you go to 44.
Right. Then you go to page 44, which actually lists the Sandy River.
Up to Marmo Dam.
Up to Marmo. And then at the beginning of each section, if you go back two, three pages to page 41 where the Willamette Zone begins.
Right.
You'll see the instructions at the top of the page.
Mm-hmm.
It says, since at first you want to read the statewide regulations, that gives you your license requirements, and then the general regulations that apply for that zone.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately below that instruction statement, it says general regulations for this zone.
Mm-hmm.
For the entire zone, then, all these general regulations apply. So for trout, the opener is April 24th to October 31st.
Mm-hmm.
Then it talks about those individual stream systems, and then open for trout May 22 through October 31 in all other streams. So if those are not the streams that you're fishing in, which you're trying to fish for the Sandy River,
mm-hmm.
then we turn the page, we go back to 44. There are also some general regulations there relative to the species of your choice, such as trout, warm water fish, and steelhead, general regulations. So those would be the regulations that would apply to any portion of the Sandy River zone that is not mentioned in this section right here that's highlighted in blue,
mm-hmm.
Where it's Sandy River main stem upstream to Marmot Dam. So those are the special regulations from the main stem upstream to Marmot Dam. You turn back to your general regulations, and these would be the regulations that would apply to all other systems within the Sandy River. Does that make sense?
I didn't follow.
You have a quick
beginning part.
Yes, I'm sure.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go
ahead.
Okay. You're still here.
And I know by going here to 44 without cross referencing, there's no way I'd get there.
Right. It's a step by step process here. If you started with your statewide regulations, which essentially tells you what your license requirements are, then you go to the zone in which the area that you're trying to fish, you would start right with those general regulations, and they're right at the beginning of each zone. It states right there, here's the dates and times that the seasons are open, and you walk right through each one of those species. The beginning of that table where it says trout, right there, it talks about what the general regulations are for trout. Then the salmon and steelhead regulations just below that, and then warm water game fish near the bottom of the page. So those are the regulations that apply unit-wide throughout the entire Willamette Zone. Okay, so that's the first primary step. Then if you're going to a specific location, such as the Sandy River, if there's more specific regulations, then that's what's on page 44. And that will give you the more specific, if there's a, you know, whether it's the Sandy or any other stretch of river, there are some special regulations. Some are fly angling only. Some have restrictions for bait. Some, there's some specific length limits. Those are all listed under those special regulations for each water body. If there are no special regulations, then you will not see that particular water body listed in that section.
First of all, I'd like to point out that testing legislators on readability of any matter is a dangerous topic vis-a-vis the general public. And second of all, I want to report to the chair that I did find Mackenzie River, and I actually understand it. All I wanted to say, I'll keep quiet for the rest of the show.
Well, let it be known that I can't open up a medical, you know, a medical bottle. You know, I qualify to at least take the test. But in follow-up to my previous question, my understanding is that there are some special regulations above Monmouth Dam, which Senator Metzger related to, and I'm not seeing any, you know, here in terms of what special regulations occur above Monmouth Dam, and that's why I wasn't sure that I was able to understand the section on page 44 after reading the earlier pages.
Right. Yeah. From that point on, upstream, then, all general regulations would apply, which are found on page 41. And there are no special regulations in above Monmouth Dam.
Well, I'm sorry, I won't belabor this because we don't have a lot of time in these meetings, but yeah, I make that leap. You know, I'm adding all this stuff together, which is still very confusing for the average Joe, and I'm right there. I'm the average Rick. So, and it says, and if you can make that leap, that this must mean this, and it's closed in all waters except noted by special regulations. And the requirements are, if it was open, only anaphos for the steelhead must be taken, whatever. And you're looking for the special regulations. You know there is catch and release above there, but I can't find that even under a special regulation. Then I assume it's closed, but I know it's not closed. I guess what I'm saying is, it would be hard for anybody who didn't know that area and worked with it to actually know what the regulation was. And I can't understand, like, we're on page 44. So that's what the Chairman Farrelly was saying. It said Sandy River upstream to Martin Dam. Why wouldn't just say Sandy River tributaries upstream from Martin Dam are, you know, catch and release only? Well, I mean, it's just so simple. You're going through all this, and it doesn't really add up. And after you've made three or four or five different leaps, you're trying to figure out what you think it means instead of just having a two-sentence thing of what it should mean. I just think it would be, you know, all the tributaries above Marmot Dam, Sandy, Zigzag, Dam and Rivers, you know, are open for steelhead must be catch and release, you know, barbless or fly only. You know, no salmon anything allowed. You know, end of story, and then people know. Actually, it would be hard for anybody. There's going to be a lot of people who don't know that area are going to be up there fishing, not knowing those new regulations that the very few fish we have. And it's going to be hard for me to tell them that they are deliberately screwing up because I don't know how to read this either.
One thing we're trying to provide for those who maybe are new to an area and are trying to figure out where some of these deadlines are, so to speak, where Marmot Dam sits, if you'll look at some of the maps that we provide at the beginning of each section, that will actually identify where that location is. There'll be a small red mark that actually identifies Marmot Dam. On the Mackenzie River, it'll also identify those key areas that are certain stretches that have different regulations per stretch, and you can actually identify or find those on the map. Granted, this is a small-scale map. You'd have to probably pull out your highway map or a state map to get a better idea of where exactly that point was.
But it makes it unduly complicated, and you're still not sure you know when if you're on a river, whether it be the Alfie River or the Trask River or the Salmon River or the Zigzag River, you're going to look there and you're going to look alphabetically for it because those are main rivers for angling and would expect to find that there with not, you know, four or five different page referrals and then trying to figure out what that means when it could easily just say what it means.
Well, I would agree with you, Mr. I think, you know, we took great pains. The Commission essentially directed the staff to simplify as best we possibly could the regulations that you've got in your hand right now. And that was a very long process with input from anybody that carries a fishing pole for any time of the year. I think there's still some things that we could do that make it a little bit more step-by-step. Just in looking at this morning, we ought to have right here on the cover a statement that says, here's how to read these regulations, here's how to understand these regulations, and then maybe have one page that took an example and walked you through that so that you could then go to each section and have a clear understanding of how the statewide regulations apply, how the general regulations apply, and then specific regulations for that area. And say right up front, if your pond or your river that you're looking for is not listed, then there are no special regulations and general regulations apply, see page X or whatever it is. It's a big document, and we've been trying to keep it to a minimum as well because just the volume of it can be pretty intimidating to folks as well. So
yeah,
there's more that can be done. We've been working with Kay Brown, who's currently our acting chief of the Habitat Division, has been in the fish division part of that for how many years, Jay? Mm-hmm. 25 years, that has been one of her primary roles and responsibilities, is trying to simplify this or make it more readable for all those years. And we've got many, many suggestions, and that are taking the ones that are really going to work and applying to this thing. So there's more work to be done, and we'll certainly take any more suggestions that will be helpful, I think, to the general public to read this thing.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's say this senator and I are on the Sandy River, and we're angling from a floating device that supports the angler upstream from the power line crossing the location 1 mile downstream from Oslo Park, and we have 3 steelhead on board. What kind of penalties should we look at?
You'd look at it because I wouldn't be on board. I appreciate it.
You have your permit. We would never say.
Yeah, we would never say.
Well, are you asking in terms of what the violations
were? What the violations
were? Well, there'd be a number of violations that could possibly occur in terms of taking the wrong species or the wrong size. Back on page 91, we talk about bail schedules and how Class A misdemeanors are applied to certain game violations. It just gives you a rundown of the different kinds. We're listed here are violations that did not involve the taking of wildlife except for violations of non-resident license provisions. It lists the current bail schedule, $75. Where you're taking different species, or either with the wrong species for the season, the wrong size, you'll see $150 bail, and then other violations. It's a stair-step approach to how essentially the courts will look at any kind of fines relative to fish and wildlife violations.
How about being in that floating device upstream? What would that involve?
I would guess that would be one of these lower violations, misdemeanors, and probably a $75 bill.
That would be a pretty expensive fishing trip. I'm not going with you. I'm going to
get there and get off.
Go ahead.
Before we start with that definition, we do have some more interesting questions from yesterday. I've got some additional handouts here we can give you. This is the chronology of input that ODFW had on the AT&T cable that we had quite a little bit of discussion over yesterday. The ocean cable systems that were recently approved for the Oregon coast. We have a list of all of the set fry releases from our salmon trout enhancement program from 1983 to 1997. That was another request from yesterday. Also some releases from Fall Creek Hatchery, the coho that I think there's been a lot of discussion on in terms of what we see in terms of our returns, both adult returns relative to the smolts that are released. We have a handout for you on that from that particular hatchery. And then relative to the CAPE on the Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting this last year, we also have the draft minutes, so we'll make sure you have those. And finally, Ken Rocco has a copy of, I believe it was the 89-91 budget for our propagation program that was also requested yesterday, and that's in that file. So with that, we'll make sure that you get those before you leave today. I'd like to introduce Kay Brown. She's the Acting Division Director for our Habitat Division, and she'll proceed with an overview of the Habitat Division program.
Kay, go ahead. And what document will you be reading from?
Mr. Chair, I'm reading from my own set of notes, but we're working from the this document in terms of if you look at page 23, that's the Habitat Division, and that's what I'll be working from.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Kay Brown, and I'm the Acting Director of the Habitat Division. What I'd like to do today, since there's been quite a bit of discussion in this committee about what the Habitat Division does and how it differs from the Habitat Division in the Wildlife Habitat Program in the Wildlife Division, or the lack of a specific Habitat Division in the Fish Division, I'd like to talk just a little bit about what the Habitat Division does and how it differs. And then I'll go into the 3 main programs of the Habitat Division. As was mentioned earlier, the Habitat Division is quite small. Our budget is around $4 million, which is about 3% of the agency budget. About half of the budget comes from other fund revenues. General fund constitutes about a quarter of the rest of the budget, and there's about a quarter that comes from federal contracts. Now, unlike the habitat programs in the Wildlife Division that actually implement habitat enhancement programs on the ground, in other words, what they're doing is the actual on-the-ground working with the landowners, developing habitat on agency land, buying equipment, purchasing feed, those kinds of things that are very expensive. The habitat program, habitat division, most of our budget is personal services. It's actually staff biologists. And what we do is provide policy guidance and technical expertise on the host of habitat issues in order to achieve a consistent field implementation by fish, wildlife, and habitat biologists. I'd like to give you some examples of that. A very good example is the guidelines for timing of in-water work. The division staff developed these guidelines to provide direction to our field staff when they apply those guidelines to people who are working in water, and it's intended to give a consistent approach in the field. What this does is by river system lists the dates that that work can be done in water. We also sent out a guidance document to all of our biologists because we recognize that there are exceptions to the rules. And in addition to wanting to provide guidance, we also want to provide flexibility so that this is not a hard and fast rule. It recognizes that there are situations where it makes sense to allow work. And an example would be if someone were putting in a bridge and all of the work was being done behind cofferdam, so there was no actual impact on the fish that was happening from the work that was being done. So that's the kind of guidance that we give our biologists, and we go in, we send out a guidance document that listed the guidelines and then gave quite a number of examples of when we would apply them and when we wouldn't. And that's the kind of work that we'll do. Example of the habitat programs that require expertise in both fish and wildlife issues is the hydro program, where fish passage and impacts on upland wildlife habitat both must be considered as part of the entire relicensing project. So having an individual staff member knowledgeable in both areas generates efficiencies in time and staffing. There have been some people who suggested that it made more sense to eliminate the habitat division and place those functions in the fish division and the wildlife division. What I'm suggesting to you is that it makes a lot more sense to have a division that looks at both aspects and can make those kinds of recommendations rather than having individual members in each division. What that does is create more efficiency. It also creates coordination between the two divisions and with the field. Another example is the Natural Resources Damage Assessment Program. The Habitat Division oversees and coordinates spill response by both fish and wildlife biologists. Take specialized training in hazardous material handling, chain of evidence, and other aspects of spill response and damage assessment. And it makes sense to have a single coordinating program that avoids duplication, avoids confusion under very stressful circumstances, and provides a single point of contact for many of the state and federal agencies that are involved in these activities.
Question ever since then?
So, on the spill, then, does DEQ take responsibility, you know, for the sites and the remedies, and you assist them, or have you got authority up to a point when you invite them in, or how does that interact?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, the department has authority over all fish and wildlife in the state. In the case of a spill, and of course the New Carissa is a perfect example of that, DEQ was the lead agency in working with the Unified Command, but it was our fish and wildlife biologists that were out in the field both assessing the situation before the oil actually came on shore, then working to protect the fish and wildlife that the oil was coming at, and then there will be follow-up studies to determine the exact effects of that oil spill. And all of that will be done by department biologists. So our role is to coordinate with DEQ, make sure that all state agencies are working together, but we have a specific role in protection and assessing what the damages were. Fish and wildlife need habitat to survive and thrive. I think we can all agree that habitat provides the essential food, water, and cover requirements during all stages of the species life cycle. And while the department has regulatory authority over fish and wildlife, authority over their habitat is governed by agencies such as the Forest Service, Water Resources Department, Department of Environmental Quality, Division of State Lands. Numerous state and federal laws either require or encourage the department's involvement in the decision-making. Our staff works closely with these state agencies, federal agencies, counties, and other jurisdictions to provide technical expertise on the habitat requirements of fish and wildlife. And this cooperative relationship with these agencies makes their decisions more informed on a variety of permits and land use actions. We also provide technical expertise and policy guidance on habitat issues related to the agency's field operations, as I described earlier.
A question, Senator George.
Right now, in the middle of Newburgh, there's a major removal and major, well, a blockage of a major highway, might be a better way to describe it, and that is 99W that goes from Portland to the coast. And the purpose of that is to remove this massive fill and to replace it with a bridge. And the reason that was given to do this, and I'm going to estimate that we're talking about probably $5 to $10 million, was for the fish. And I talked to a couple of old timers. This was the stream that goes up past George Fox University. And they said they don't ever remember any salmon being in there. Did you guys participate in that decision on that? That's a major project. It would appear to be minimal gain. If you went 1 mile to the north, it soon disappears into farmland.
Chair, Senator George, I'm not familiar with that particular process, but what I can tell you is in all of those land use actions, like fill and removal, we do have a role. We make recommendations to the Department of State Lands, who issues permits for the fill and removal. Now, whether or not it was our recommendation that requested that area to be opened up for fish habitat, I'm certain I can find out more details about it if you want.
Can you do that for me?
Yeah. I'd like to talk more specifically about the three major programs in the division. A water program supports Oregon plan-related activities within and outside the agency. For example, we're working closely with the Water Resources Department on protection of flows and in-stream water rights for fish. The hydro program that I mentioned before is part of the water program. They work cooperatively with private utilities. The Habitat Division's hydro program supports the state hydro relicensing process as part of the hydroelectric application review team. That team is a coordinated multi-agency process for developing recommendations to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It's kind of a new process for us. It's a very difficult process because we are negotiating with other agencies who have different interests, and we are it's becoming more familiar to us and more comfortable, but it has been quite a process for us to learn to work cooperatively with agencies rather than coming in as one state agency making recommendations which might be inconsistent with another state agency. Now all state agencies are trying to work together on that. We also have regional hydrobiologists that are working cooperatively with the local hydro programs. Our land program is responsible for developing statewide land use standards to protect fish and wildlife, the one I mentioned earlier, the in-stream water timing guidelines is one, and we assist county and state planners in creating and applying land use goals. Staff in this program also assist federal and state agencies in developing regulations and management plans that improve habitat conditions for fish and wildlife. And our staff has been actively working to implement and monitor these activities as part of the Oregon plan. They also work directly with landowners by providing technical expertise on a variety of habitat issues. We also provide assistance to landowners and the Division of State Lands with review of removal and fill permits, as we were talking about earlier, and leases of state lands. There's a number of tax incentive programs that are coordinated through the division that ensure that landowner access to these programs are available to them when they choose to improve a conserved habitat. These incentive programs are an important link with the Oregon plan as part of developing cooperative programs. An example is the Fish Habitat Tax Credit that was extended through January 2004 under House Bill 2949, and was a bill that we introduced. And as I mentioned earlier, the Natural Resources Damage Assessment Program is also part of our land program, coordinating spills for the department, assuring that the agency staff are trained in spill response and coordination of fish and wildlife protection and assessment activities. And then the third program in the division is the Habitat Database Program. And this program manages our standardized fish, wildlife, and habitat databases that support and analyze habitat and species information throughout the department. These common databases help prevent duplication of agency efforts and provide a medium for working cooperatively with other state and federal agencies in information exchange. Information is used in a wide variety of applications, including many of the Oregon Plan monitoring and analysis projects, working with our federal partners on land management plans, and capturing biological information that's distributed to regions and districts throughout the state to assist them with their management functions. Those are the three programs within the division. As much as possible, functions of the Habitat Division are organized to provide a local watershed approach to habitat protection, with habitat biologists located in the field that work directly with landowners in developing habitat management plans and developing some creative solutions to habitat mitigation and permit reviews in their specific areas. Hydrobiologists are also located in the field to work directly with local hydro operators. And we intend to continue to provide policy guidance for field operations to ensure consistency in field implementation, which allows flexibility to accommodate local situations. And I know that there has been a number of discussions about the department not providing specific direction to our field, and there is inconsistency in the field. It's an issue that we're well aware of. We're working to provide that guidance to staff. We think in some areas we're doing quite well, and others we need to do a better job, and we'll be doing that in the future. And that concludes my presentation. Be happy to answer any questions.
I have a question for later 3225. Maybe you're the right person to help me out. Is there such a thing as a native habitat?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, I was sitting in the back of the room yesterday squirming. I think that when they were referring to native habitat, they were referring to habitat that consists of native plants. My preference was to strike that out of the bill and to just talk about habitat in general. I think that there's probably native and non-native vegetation that does provide cover and other kind of benefits to wildlife.
Thank you. We're calling it a drafting error. And essentially, there is no structure in Measure 66 to talk about native habitat. So I think the discussions that we've been having on native species, they have put that term in the mind of the drafting team that's working on that bill. But you'd have to specifically define native habitat in statute, and then the argument over that would start and last another 100 years. So I think we've already instructed that drafting error to be corrected in the next iteration of the bill.
Just trying to here's a moment of opportunity there.
It's a good apprehension and a good draft, because that was one that stumbled, everybody stumbled over that one yesterday. And then we couldn't figure out who it was that put forth the concept. And if nobody has the same idea, it's usually not a very good idea. But then that's the latest use.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. Number one, what type of, or do your habitat staff have special training? They trained at Oregon State or Washington State or someplace for habitat type work, or what requirements are for those people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Netherly, most of our habitat biologists are either a fish or a wildlife biologist and have training from Oregon State or a variety of other institutions around the country. In addition, they do go to special training on habitat that's put on by a variety of different agencies. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, Forest Service have put on that kind of training. So we do try to make sure that our people are trained technically in assessing watersheds and habitat.
And are you saying there's a degree that is offered to them then for habitat?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nesley, there's not a degree in habitat. There's a degree in fisheries or wildlife that many of them have. We also have people who are trained in land use and those kinds of things.
I would assume that you have people who have also had experience or training in forestry and maybe agriculture.
That's correct.
Second question, Mr. Chair, from my we've heard an awful lot about, like 2 years ago, the most of the talk was about spawning habitat. This session, we're hearing more about rearing habitat. And I'm interested in the database that is established as to the to prioritize the need for rearing habitat. And where's the science that would tell us that this is a critical factor now in our fisheries, and the reason for our fisheries not returning?
Mr. Chair, Representative Netherly, there's a variety of technical papers that have been written on spawning and rearing habitats and the importance of them, and I can try to provide those for you. Generally, an area that is is designated as a critical habitat or essential semi-arid habitat will be either because it is spawning habitat or rearing habitat, but we think that those are both critical elements in the life cycle of the salmon.
Mr. Chair, could I follow up one more? And I would agree, they're very important, but what I'm looking for is the science that would tell us that this is to be a highest priority or a higher priority as compared to other priorities and what's going on. You know, such as ocean habitat, predation, rearing habitat, spawning habitat, and there's probably a lot of other factors that we could consider too, but is there science that tells us that this is an area that is absolutely critical to what's going on with the resource?
Chair, Representative Nesbitt, I'm not quite sure how to answer your question. Certainly, it's a high priority. I don't know of any document that says that's a higher priority than ocean conditions or other factors. I think we can measure generally if you don't have rearing habitat or you don't have spawning habitat, how that might impact the population. But I'm not sure that I can answer your question very well.
One more just statement, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get an understanding of my own mind. How do we prioritize as we're trying to figure out our funding and our staffing? And certainly I'm not saying that you can compare if we don't have habitat. I mean, that's not the issue at all. Do we have adequate habitat, or how much more habitat would be adequate for the resource we're talking about? Those are the kind of questions I'm asking.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Netherly, I think there's quite a bit of information in the Oregon plan itself in terms of our management measures that are intended to protect fish. And I think that in terms of identifying core areas where we believe that those are the essential areas that we need to protect, we have prioritized those areas. But in terms, I'd be happy to get back to you because I'm just not quite sure how to answer your question, but there may well have been some additional work in terms of what's more important, working with predators or working with spawning habitat, but I can't think of what that would be right now.
Thank you.
Further questions? First question?
For example, idle zone habitats be outside your jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, as far as the state is concerned, we have authority for Fish and Wildlife out to 3 miles, so that is part of my jurisdiction in terms of the habitat requirements.
A follow-up?
Follow-up?
So do you do anything in those areas?
Mr. Chair, Representative King, we...
proactive in these things.
Our budget and our personnel are quite limited. We do have a habitat position in the marine program that works on an estuary habitat.
Thank you. Additional questions?
I have a couple. In the consideration of the Department of Forestry budget, we talked about the relative interface between the state and federal agencies that have co-management responsibility for fire and some other issues. One of the issues that came up was pest management, bug infestations, and how the agencies cooperate to report mortality in forests and some other things. There's some analogies to the way the Department of Fish and Wildlife deals with federal agencies, and I was wondering if you could characterize how the agencies interface on habitat issues.
Chair. I'm fairly new to the Habitat Division, so I probably am somewhat remiss in being able to tell you all of the ways that we interface because I'm just learning myself. Mm-hmm. But I do know that we work with the Corps of Engineers, we work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we work with National Fisheries Service on a variety of different things. And to give you a specific, the New Carissa is an area where we have worked with a number of federal agencies relative to Fish and Wildlife Protection. We work closely with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the snowy plover and our concerns about protecting those. Our biologists that are familiar with snowy plovers worked hand in hand during that period when they were most at risk and helped develop the recommendations for the studies that would be conducted to make sure that they're protected in the future. We worked with the Bureau of Land Management because it was on their land that the snowy plovers were on. We worked with the U.S. Forest Service, again, in some of the wildlife surveys that we were working on. So there was a variety of different areas where we were working closely with our federal counterparts in that particular thing. I suspect that happens throughout the state on a variety of different issues.
Okay, I mean, I guess the issues that I'm interested in learning about, but particularly just big game habitat management issues and wildlife management issues in general on federal lands that are managed by BLM and Forest Service. So that's a tremendous percentage of the land base in Oregon, over 60%. And we don't... it's my impression that we don't see the kind of habitat management on federal lands that we do on state and private lands. And I was curious to know whether or not there's a real collaboration between federal land managers who manage those public lands on behalf of all of us and the state agencies that are responsible for wildlife management. And I get the impression from looking at least forest lands on the east side, some rangelands, but more particularly forest lands, that there's a fairly deteriorated condition just in terms of high mortality, overstocked lands. And those all, of course, provide a different kind of niche for wildlife habitat. But in terms of big game habitat or large ungulates,
thinner, healthier, more open stands are better for some types of uses, not necessarily hiding a thermal cover, but certainly for grades. And I just wonder if there's any mechanism that the agency uses to characterize the quality of wildlife habitat on federal land, and whether there's any kind of comparative discrimination or judgment or analysis made about the quality of habitat across the ownership spectrum. In other words, I think the best habitat tends to be the stuff that is in the lowlands that's managed by private landowners, and maybe that's very close to the way habitat is managed on state lands. And it tends to be, I think, a very high-quality habitat. I don't know if that's the standard that you could say applies to the federal land management base, and say our multiple use managers, they don't emphasize anything particularly, and some people think they don't manage anything very well. So I guess the question is there any idea in the agency about the relative quality of habitat? And how does the agency manage the wildlife, which is a state responsibility, on federal land base, which is beyond your jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to answer some piece of it, and then I'll ask Director Greer, because he's probably more familiar with some of the wildlife
sure.
issues. But I would like to say that we have a role in reviewing the federal forest plans, and so we do have the ability to get our input in on that, and we have done that in a variety of different areas. As far as our working relationship with the federal land managers, that's generally done at a local level with our district wildlife biologists, and they generally work closely together. But as far as the habitat division is concerned, we don't really have, at least at this point, any rules in place that I'm aware of that we would use to compare federal land to state land. So there may be some areas that we could improve upon in that way.
Okay.
I think what we've used in the past is standards and guidelines that have been run through the Habitat Division but then implemented through the Fish and Wildlife Division. A couple of key documents that we've used over the years were cooperatively put together between ourselves and federal managers. One was the Blue Mountains habitat relationships, which goes through the whole gambit of the kinds of habitats that are available in the Blue Mountains and what kind of activities on those grounds may actually change what that habitat would look like over time relative to timber management or agricultural practices. What we created then was standards that we wanted to see met, which you referred to earlier, for big game, such as hiding and thermal cover ratios that we wanted to maintain over time. And that was then integrated into their planning documents that Kay was referring to, which essentially are 10-year living documents that the Forest Service uses. As they update those, then we'll work hand in glove with them to make sure that those criteria that come out of those habitat relationship guidelines are inserted into their programs that focus on timber harvest or agricultural practices. There is a lot of grazing that's done on national forest lands, and that's where our input is at that stage of the game. Now, recently you've probably heard about this ecosystem management approach for all of eastern Washington and Oregon that the Forest Service has done a multi-million-dollar review of in terms of trying to get the landscape to be at its healthiest and still provide levels of fish, wildlife, and timber products and everything else that's interrelated on the ground. We have some major concerns in that. One of their tools they're going to be using more in the future is fire. Because fire has been suppressed, we've seen a lot of the stands over the years build up quite a heavy layer of debris that now is classified as a very high risk area in terms of forest fires in the future. So they're trying to mimic what Mother Nature used to do in the good old days with lightning in terms of creating those scenarios that takes away some of that high-risk fuel underloading and still provide some good habitat areas for fish, wildlife, and create stands that are manageable in terms of forest practices. Sometimes they go a little bit too far in terms of our thinking because they'd like to see that habitat turn over in a shorter period of time than that might have very substantial impacts to, say, mule deer or elk on winter range. So right now we're working very closely with the regional offices and making sure that whatever their next 10-year plan looks like, it's going to take into consideration what we believe are still good forage versus habitat versus thermal cover kinds of ratios out there, so we don't see these really peaks and valleys in terms of impact on big game, which would occur if, in fact, that habitat changed overnight in large areas across eastern Oregon. So we do work very closely with them, particularly on this large-scale planning effort. And that's where we see, I think, the Habitat Division folks playing a key role relative to statewide issues and statewide concepts that we want to see applied throughout eastern Oregon. But there's a lot of different ways that we link up with those federal land managers. But as Kay said, I think most of our on-the-ground efforts, the most effective ones, are where we deal with our Fish and Wildlife District biologists and the local ranger district or the local BLM district manager.
The message, one of the messages that I came away with yesterday from the public hearing was that big game is tending to be displaced from the federal lands to the private lands because of the relatively high quality of feed and access to water. And the ownership pattern of land tends to privatize the bottom land, the river valleys. That's where people homesteaded, that's where the donation of land claims were made, that's where the private land is located primarily. The uplands tend to be a mosaic of public and private. But I got the clear impression that private landowners felt that there was a displacement of big game animals onto private land from public land, and I wondered if that had to do with the relative quality of habitat that is found on the public land. And it's like every other issue. For instance, the grazing opportunities on public lands put a lot of management responsibility on the cattle ranchers. And part of that responsibility is for upland watering, which creates opportunities to take ungulates out of the creek bottoms and up to the uplands just as it does for cattle, which makes for better riparian vegetation, so on and so forth. But I'm not sure that's problematic, and I'm not sure it's aimed at wildlife. I know it's aimed at cattle. And I guess I'm not feeling very comfortable that there's an integrated management opportunity between the federal agency and the State Department of Fish and Wildlife that looks at a large a set of these kinds of trends and comes up with a concerted effort, an integrated effort, a comprehensive management plan that deals with habitat improvement on public land. You know, you're worried about fire. I'm worried about treatment altogether. We're not seeing very much investment in doing adaptive or active management on the federal land base. And this habitat is deteriorating, and the potential for catastrophic fire is increasing. So you ought to be concerned about that. That's the proclivity of the agency to want to introduce fire. And the potential for a loss of quality habitat goes up exponentially. And if it's our fishing game, we ought to be pushing the envelope and making the federal agencies meet standards, even though we have no statutory authority to do it. We certainly have the authority to manage the wildlife, even if it's on federal land. That's one of those envelopes. We're not pushing the envelope on fire protection. We're not doing what I think is reasonable management on vectoring for pests like bugs, the insects, the swift needle cats, and the other things that we're seeing on coastal, from one part of Oregon to another. And I don't think we're doing what we need to be doing for a comprehensive wildlife management plan that includes the federal agencies as real partners. So I'd like to see the state step up in the natural resource platform and say to the federal agencies, meet or exceed our standards, even though they're federal land bases. So, personal prejudice. Anybody else have one? We have a score session starting at the quarter after the Senate, so we need to make haste to our desk. I'll start at 10. Tomorrow we need to be through the final two areas to finish up with the habitat management and going through the law enforcement area and then cover the administrative issues. So are we pretty well through the habitat section?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so tomorrow we need to get through enforcement and administration to stay on our schedule. Representative?
Yes, absolutely. Why am I going to be convinced to a vote for appropriation money for two different habitats, for a habitat division and then a wildlife habitat program, where I see some apparent duplication.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, there is no duplication. What we're talking about in the Wildlife Division is implementation on the ground, providing habitat for wildlife. What we do in the Habitat Division is we provide policy guidance to our fish, wildlife, and habitat biologists in terms of statewide policy and how we're going to implement those regulations. So we're really talking about two very different things. We're coordinating with all of our fish, wildlife, and habitat biologists to make sure that we're implementing those policies and standards on the ground.
Very, very great. If we have data that we're getting downstream migration in pretty good shape, and I don't know if we have that kind of data on all streams, but I understand that some of our coastal streams are. We develop some data on that. Then I'd like a discussion at some point as to if we should be shifting our staffing to the rearing habitat, if we're identifying that as a bigger problem, or the justification for not doing that. And maybe my information is wrong, but it's my understanding that we are finding that we do have pretty good downstream migration of most of all types of species. And I haven't heard that kind of discussion, but publicly. But if that's the case, shouldn't we be shifting where we're putting our emphasis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mesley, we'll be looking at in terms of our monitoring programs and where we do need to emphasize it, and we'll get back to you as far as information that might help you with that.
Thank you. We'll reconvene tomorrow.